Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer, together with analysts today, Donna Hoffman, the Chuck and Barbara Grassley Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Donna.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to Jonathan Hasid as well, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Ben.
And we invite our listeners to join us as we survey, half dozen political news items and get Donna's and Jonathan's views on those. But please chip in with your questions. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Later in the program, we'll talk about why President Biden is spending 3 days in Pennsylvania in this critical swing state. Also, a Supreme Court case heard this week that could upend charges against January 6th rioters and has a bearing on charges against former President Trump. Also, how does Iran's attack on Israel on the weekend change the debate, if at all, over Gaza? Some of the things we'll look at later in the program. Let's start off with the congressional news items, first of all, and go back to remind ourselves that this foreign aid package has been paralyzed after the Senate, and this was an overwhelming vote, passed it in February, $95 billion that funds not only Ukraine and Israel, but also money for the Indo-Pacific and humanitarian aid for Gaza. But a bill passed by the Senate, unpopular with some House Republicans. Now we have two far-right lawmakers in the House threatening to oust Speaker Mike Johnson over plans to fund Ukraine and Israel. If they move ahead, it would mean Republicans could remove their second speaker in 6 months. Johnson has been at that post for 6 months. Now, he introduced a four-part proposal Monday, decoupling aid in these areas, Israel, Ukraine, Indo-Pacific, and humanitarian aid. And let's listen to Speaker Johnson respond to the calls for his resignation.
I am not resigning, and it is, in my view, an absurd notion that someone would bring a vacate motion when we are simply here trying to do our jobs. It is not helpful to the cause. It is not helpful to the country. It does not help the House Republicans advance our agenda, which is in the best interest of the American people here, a secure border, sound governance. And it's not helpful to the unity that we have in the body. Look, we have a very important mission here. Our mission is very clear. The reason most of us, I can speak for the House Republicans, the reason every House Republican ran for Congress is that because they wanted to come here and help to save this beleaguered republic of ours. We want to save the country.
Donna Hoffman, to you first. How perilous is Speaker Johnson's hold on the leadership position?
I think it's kind of unclear at this moment. Because Democrats could help him out here. And I'm sure there's lots of things going on behind the scenes about what that might, in fact, look like. Typically, when you vote for a speaker or on something like a motion to vacate, it's a strict party line vote. And as we saw in October, I believe it was, when McCarthy was ousted, you know, the Democrats stayed together. They voted for Hakeem Jeffries for Speaker of the House, because that's typically the nature of that vote. When you vote for a speaker, it is something that, generally speaking, you as a party stay together on. But under the right circumstances, you could have at least some Democrats coming in to save Johnson's speakership, which in fact would put him in worse peril with his Republican conference. Probably there would probably be more Republicans that would peel off in that instance, but he might still be able to retain his speakership. But Democrats aren't just going to do that out of the goodness of their heart. They're mm-hmm. going to want something, and Ukraine is probably wrapped up in that. And as the clip kind of alluded to, Ukraine is part of it, at what's at the root of why a few members of the Extreme Freedom Caucus are unhappy with him. Massey, who's the one that has now signed on or is going to sign on to Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to vacate, is mainly, as I understand it, unhappy with the fact that Johnson is going to bring up the Ukraine bill altogether. And that bill has been fraught even before. In your intro, you talked about when it, you know, it overwhelmingly in February passed the House.
Yep.
Remember, or the Senate, I mean. Remember before that, they had coupled in the Senate a bill with very strong border security measures that at least initially was something that Republicans wanted to see go with that. But then at the point that Donald Trump essentially wanted the border to be an issue in the 2024 election, they torpedoed that. Then they moved that standalone bill. You could still, another thing that you might see, and this is getting into the weeds in congressional procedure, which I really like to do, is that there is a discharge petition in the House. These are a majoritarian means that you can bypass essentially the leadership. And so if they can get a majority of House members to sign on to a discharge petition that would discharge the rule on that previous Senate bill that was passed, which is ideally what Democrats would like to have voted for, then you could bypass the four bills that Johnson wants to do, and you could bring that Senate bill from February up to a vote. Last I checked on that, I think they were at like 195 signatures, but there are some Republicans who generally have not yet signed off on it that might do that because of their overall frustration with the fractiousness of the caucus, including that motion to vacate and the procedural things that are going on. And so there are a lot of dynamics here that you could see in the House that might not be well understood by the general public, but is part of how the House operates.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, to you, what dynamics, to use Donna's word there, do you want to comment on?
Well, Donna did such a fantastic job. I think one thing that's interesting is that we have if Democrats save Johnson's speakership, which they might, as Donna pointed out, do for reasons of politics, then we're really moving into uncharted territory. We've got essentially a coalition government, a parliamentary style coalition government, where essentially you'd have three parties in the U.S. Congress, right? You'd have the Democrats, you'd have, I guess, mainline Republicans around Johnson, and then you'd have presumably some Freedom Caucus type people essentially in a different party, which is, unusual dynamics for the United States. And essentially it would be up to Johnson to survive what would amount to a series of confidence motions on his government. It's totally normal politics for Canada, but for the United States, it's odd.
Right. And to have Hakeem Jeffries, Jonathan, as the speaker is a possibility. Is it how real of a possibility do you see that as?
I think it's a much more realistic possibility that Democrats will support Johnson's speakership in exchange for concessions, which of course would be devastatingly unpopular to Johnson's right, rather than seeing Hakeem Jeffries as speaker. I mean, it's possible, of course. I mean, ironically, he may have the most number of votes of anybody, but it seems to me that it would be the ultimate sort of Republican humiliation to have, a minority government leading the House when theoretically the Republican Party has the seats to be able to have its own majority. So that I think they'd come together to prevent that at all costs. Even Matt Gaetz during the last leadership spill was promising, I don't know to the extent that his promises are worthwhile, but he was promising, not to have Jeffries as speaker.
Mm-hmm. Do you also agree, Donna, that's the most likely if we have Democrats supporting Speaker Johnson rather than Hakeem Jeffries as speaker?
Yes, I do believe, because I don't think you're going to have any. You could have Republicans voting present. You could have all kinds of dynamics there. But I'm not sure that, really at this moment in time, Jeffries even wants to be speaker under these conditions. And so I do think that Johnson would try to prop Johnson up. But again, we're in such uncharted territory here that lots of things could happen. One of the other related things here is that, typically the House majority doesn't lose rule votes. And they last week lost, I think it was the fourth under Johnson, the seventh of this Congress in which the majority lost a vote on the rule. And that just essentially doesn't happen. Before this Congress, it had been, I think, 10 years before that it had happened before. So it was a really, really rare thing. It's now becoming more common. And it just helps to illustrate the small margin that Johnson has in the House, and it's at, you know, the Republicans are at 218 right now, but by Friday they're going to be down to 217, and because they have a resignation that we know is coming on Friday, and so that makes this almost an ungovernable majority, especially when you have a really vocal, fractious element of that conference, the Freedom Caucus, trying to get as much as they possibly can. And, you know, what it is essentially doing is making Johnson's life as Speaker really quite miserable. And so, again, the dynamics here are just something that we've really not seen before.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, we have a couple minutes before the break, but perhaps you could comment on Speaker Johnson's strategy here of decoupling this aid package. You know, we have Ukraine, Israel, the Indo-Pacific, humanitarian aid into four different measures. Pretty much adds up to the same $90-plus billion, I think. But this is... perhaps you could call it a contortion to try to get something through. Help us understand that strategy.
You know, I think he's trying everything he can. I mean, his predecessor couldn't govern with the caucus, and he's really struggling. So, you know, why not try? I mean, this way, at least, you know, half a loaf or even perhaps a quarter of a loaf is better, I presume, to him than no loaf at all. And so in that sense, if he can get one or two or obviously all four of the bills through, then, you know, that would presumably fit his priorities. Right. And so if he can get parts of them through, I suppose that's what he's trying to do. I mean, whether or not that's a successful strategy is another question. But I suppose from this point, you know, the question is really what choice does he have? He's got to. As Donna points out, his margin is ridiculously thin now. He can't afford to lose anyone on any issue in a caucus that's extremely fractious. It's really at least two parties stuck together. And so, you know, he might as well try everything he can.
Yep.
You know, whether or not it'll work, well, I guess we'll see.
Okay. And we'll see how that plays out and analyze it in the weeks to come, no doubt. When we come back, we're going to stick with Congress and talk about how yesterday afternoon House Republicans sent impeachment articles against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate. They made this ceremonial walk across the Capitol from one chamber to the other to present the articles charging Mayorkas, and we'll talk about that when we return. Join us with your questions, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Our guests, political scientist Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jonathan Hasid with us of Iowa State University this hour, as well as Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, two political scientists as we chew through some of the latest highlights on our national political front here. Let's stay with Congress before turning to, of course, this week's start of the Trump trial in Manhattan. Yesterday afternoon, House Republicans sent impeachment articles against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate. I saw footage of this. This is a ceremonial walk. I don't know if there were about a dozen of these House Republicans walking across the Capitol to the other chamber, presenting articles charging Mayorkas with, quote, willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law and breach of public trust, commencing what, according to reports, likely will be a brief trial. We'll see in the upper chamber. The Senate could conclude, according to what I read, as soon as Wednesday. Now, Senate Democrats hold a 51-49 majority in that upper house, planning to band together to dismiss or table the trial. Let's listen to some voices on this before we get Jonathan and Donna's read on it, Senator Joni Ernst, our U.S. Senator from Iowa, one of ours, told Newsmax yesterday that it is our constitutional duty to hold the impeachment trial against Secretary Mayorkas.
Well, I think that most of the Republicans do understand how consequential this is. We have 7.5 million illegal migrants that have come into the country in the course of the past 3.5 years. Our homeland is not safe now due to Secretary Mayorkas willfully not following the law, systematically refusing to follow the law when it comes to immigration and border enforcement. So I think that Republicans are together on this. We may even have a few Democrats that would also agree that we have to hold Secretary Mayorkas accountable. But to do that, we have to have a trial.
Democrats denouncing this impeachment effort. At a news conference, House Democrats said the effort was being led by, quote, extremists in the GOP. Here a comment from Congressman Hakeem Jeffries from New York.
House Republicans have clearly turned their ever-shrinking majority over to the extremists. And this sham impeachment of Secretary Mayorkas is just another sad example.
Jonathan, start us off on this issue. Help us understand what's going on here. Is this all politics? Are there some substance? What are your thoughts on the trial or what we'll see happen in the Senate now?
It's all politics. I think, you know, there is obviously an issue at the U.S. border. There has been for a very, very long time. During fiscal year 2019, the Customs and Border Patrol reported over 1 million so-called enforcement actions at the border, which was, of course, when Trump was president, right? So this is not, you know, a Biden issue necessarily, but it's, you know, the fact is that it's a policy dispute that the Republicans in the House want and the Senate, I suppose, want, you know, more vigorous enforcement at the border, which is, you know, not up to Congress to dictate to the executive branch sort of how a policy is enforced. And so, you know, I mean, the precedent for this is sort of unusual. During the Andrew Johnson administration, there were attempts to impeach Johnson's officials because they did similar things. They didn't follow policy that Congress liked. So it's been a while since. I mean, there might be some other you know, examples that I'm missing in the interim. But this kind of thing doesn't happen very often for what essentially amounts to the fact that, you know, the Republicans don't like conditions at the border. Someone needs to be blamed. And here is a convenient way to score some political points. I think it's difficult to imagine that, you know, even more draconian enforcement at the border would not solve the fundamental problem that's, you know, pushing migration across the border. Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, this group of House Republicans marched these impeachment articles as per the Constitution to the upper chamber. Donna, to what degree does the U.S. Constitution demand a trial at this point?
Well, so those people who marched those articles of impeachment over were the House managers. So it's their job, if there is a trial, to present the evidence of the House. And, you know, this is Schumer basically has two options here. He can, in terms of getting this off the plate of the Senate, which is what he wants to do, they could table the charges. If they table the charges, that's not something that is debatable. And so that would quickly move this off the Senate's plate. Or he could argue to dismiss the charges or offer a motion to dismiss the charges. That is debatable, so that would allow for some back and forth in that regard. It's unclear to me, and I believe the Senate is being sworn in, you know, probably was sworn in at the top of the hour, actually, to be those jurors, which is what the Constitution requires in a trial in the Senate. It's unclear to me what Schumer's going to do. There's nothing that says the Senate can't table this, that the Senate can't dismiss this. If we go back to the second impeachment of Donald Trump, in fact, Joni Ernst, you played the clip there, voted to dismiss the charges, I'm pretty sure, on Trump in that second impeachment. And the dynamics there are a bit different. That was a president. It was after he was out of office. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of different conditions there. But the Senate is not under an obligation necessarily to actually proceed to that full-blown trial. There is also an option in which, and they've done this in the past with judges, where they could have a separate commission or a separate committee of the Senate deal with this while the larger Senate can still do its procedural things, because if they're sitting in the trial, they're limited in what else they can do. And so that there's a precedent for that, too. And so you may see something along those lines. But my guess is that we'll see something relatively quick in which Schumer may try to give at least a little bit of debate here on this, but not a full-blown trial is my guess. But again, we're kind of in uncharted waters here,
yeah,
kind of like with the House.
You mentioned the impeachment to the twice impeached former president and what we went through years ago for that. Donna, in what way or is this at all, from the Republicans' point of view, payback for those impeachments?
I don't know that it's payback per se, but it certainly is a ratcheting up of the politics of impeachment. And impeachment has always been a political act. And so it is unusual that you would have a cabinet official impeached, as Jonathan mentioned. But, you know, it is largely seen as being reserved for malfeasance, right? I took a bribe or something to that effect. I'm no longer suitable to serve an office. It has not typically been seen as something that you would use when there is a matter of a policy difference. And that's what this is about. And quite frankly, if, you know, Republicans wanted the border to operate better, they could have passed the bill that we were talking about earlier that was linked with the Ukrainian foreign aid earlier in the year. You know, to some degree, some of the problems at the border are lack of funding. There's not enough funding for the immigration courts to hear asylum appeals. Congress has the power of the purse. Border Patrol could be beefed up. That's, again, Congress has to fund that. And so this, as Jonathan, you know, mentioned, this is a political issue. And so while I don't think it's, you know, an explicit payback in that sense, although had, you know, the Biden impeachment articles earlier in the year actually gotten through the House, which they've been stopped at this point, I think that might have been a payback. This is a little bit more complicated, I think, than that, but it does represent a difference in that we're going to start using impeachment for policy differences. That's not typically how most people will say impeachment mechanism in the Constitution was designed.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. Ben Kiefer with Donna Hoffman today of the University of Northern Iowa, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. Let's move on to the beginning of the very first Donald Trump trial this week. Jurors being selected in this first week of the criminal trial in New York, in Manhattan. The process continuing today. From what I've read, the trial's opening statements could begin as soon as next week. The former president accused of falsifying business records to cover up a sexual scandal involving a porn star. The trial is expected to last about 6 weeks. Jonathan, so much to pick apart here, but what are your observations so far about this trial? Because there's what's happening in the courtroom and then what's happening outside the courtroom and across our country as this is viewed.
Of course. You know, we'll have to, I mean, I think the trial's not going to move the needle, if at all, until the end, right? Until we have a verdict. And so in that sense, it's that the sort of whatever happens during the trial, I think, is not going to be hugely determinative on the election unless, you know, Trump winds up doing some sort of outburst and gets himself jailed for contempt or something like that. So, you know, legally, the trial will move on, right? Trump obviously wants it delayed. That's what he, you know, he's kept trying to do. But this is, there's going to deliver a verdict. And if he's guilty, I would imagine that, you know, he'll appeal, of course. And he's, the likelihood of him spending time behind bars before November are slim. But it that potentially could, of course, have an impact on the election. I think, you know, the optics of the trial, of course, are not great for Trump. I mean, to the extent that Trump supporters or opponents are movable, and it seems like they mostly aren't, right? So mostly we're talking about the independents in the middle who are potentially affected by this. The optics aren't great. They keep Trump off the campaign trail, which, you know, he can't do rallies. He can't run campaign events. He can't call for money. And I think... one thing that's really struck out to me is that the intensity of support among Trump supporters seems to be down compared to 4 years ago. If you look at things like the number of individual donations that a campaign receives. So Trump is down something like, compared to this time of the 2020 campaign, something like down 200,000 people as donors, which suggests that the trials, to the extent that Trump's trying to use the trials to gin up publicity, right, and create a circus atmosphere, that may not be working so well. And of course, the fact that Trump appeared to fall asleep doesn't help his case against his opponent, an opponent he calls Sleepy Biden, right? That's undoubtedly going to appear in campaign ads.
I think Sleepy Joe is the term that he's been.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Sleepy Joe. You're right. Exactly. Sleepy Joe. Yes. That's kind of a nice, if Biden's, I'm sure the campaign will use that.
Outside the courtroom, very interesting. Donald Trump taken to addressing reporters in these short bursts, bashing the case, bashing the judge's decisions, the former president trotting out really a host of false and misleading claims to defend his conduct, and portraying himself as a victim of political persecution, a victim of persecution by the sitting president. Donna, what are your observations so far?
Well, it's not persecution, right? It's a prosecution. And furthermore, it's not in a federal court where you might at least plausibly kind of maybe link an administration to a prosecution. But even that would be a stretch. This is the New York State Court. And so it is, the larger Trump playbook of how he tackles things that he encounters that are roadblocks for him, right? It's always him versus the world. And so, if thoughtful citizens are paying attention to what is happening, then this doesn't really play all that well, as Jonathan suggested, right? This is Trump, what Trump wants more than anything is control of a situation and to be able to define the narrative. And that's what he's trying to do. But in a courtroom situation, he is at a severe disadvantage from the way he normally operates. There's a lack of control. He has to sit there. He has to be quiet. His lawyer was admonished yesterday during jury selection for some kind of mild outburst or comment, I think it was, that Trump said that might have been overheard by a juror. And so that the judge kind of took as being potential juror intimidation. And so Trump has to be very careful in this forum. And I don't think it's a winning strategy. I never have thought it was a winning strategy for a major party's nominee to think that being indicted and then put on trial is actually going to win you votes. But the GOP went into this with full, knowledge in January when the Iowa caucuses started that Trump was under indictment, in dozens of times, and that trials were likely to start during the nomination process because we should recognize, still in that process,
right?
Technically,
right, right.
And so,
go ahead.
The GOP chose this strategy, or at least chose that Donald Trump was going to be their nominee, even though they had other qualified people to contest that. But that's not the direction they went.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Donald Trump, the presumed presidential nominee for the Republicans. We have those conventions yet to come in the coming months. But Donna, have you seen anything so far, that might derail Donald Trump's third bid for the White House, his nominee bid?
Well, if it hasn't been derailed up to this point, I really can't quite imagine what that would be. I mean, quite frankly, he could be incarcerated and still be elected president. There's nothing that's not a requirement
really?
From serving in the Constitution for president. And, Eugene Debs back in the day as the candidate for the Socialist Party ran for the presidency from jail. And obviously he didn't win. But there's nothing that prevents that from happening. So, I think there's still a lot here to develop, and anything, quite frankly, can happen. And it isn't technically locked in until you get to that convention. But, given all the things that we saw Trump do before the 2016 election, where lots of political commentators would say, oh, well, the Access Hollywood tape, that's the end of the road for Donald Trump, or, fill in the blank with many of the things that are norm breaking that he has done. And the norms just have changed, or he's just an anomaly in that sense. And it hasn't prevented him from, being the de facto nominee of the Republican Party. So I'm not exactly sure what would happen that would prevent the GOP from going down a different path.
Jonathan, a minute or so before the break, what are the likely scenarios you see going forward? We have three other criminal trials here. This, as I understand, is am I right here? This is the only one, or perhaps likely to be the only one that happens or is completed before the general election?
I think that's probably right. I mean, the the one in Georgia may go ahead before the start, before the November elections. But yeah, I think probably this is the only one that will, that's certainly likely to be decided by then. Although undoubtedly, of course, Trump will appeal if he loses. And so, you know, the appeals will, of course, have to wind their way through the New York State judicial system. But yeah, I mean, I mean, Donna's right. You know, this is the voters went into this with wide open eyes. And ultimately, Trump, if he's convicted of a crime and the party and various, let's say, elites of the party, various party delegates want, for some reason, would like to remove him at the convention, they would be, you know, flayed alive by their constituents. I mean, ultimately, Donald Trump is the nominee, not because Republican Party officials like him, but because huge chunks of the Republican Party base do. And regardless of what you do at the top, those voters are still there, you know.
Okay.
And so that, yeah.
We'll be back after a short break with Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. When we come back, we'll talk about the current president's three-day tour of Pennsylvania and what are the crucial battleground states.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Back with more of River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer. We have analysis this hour from Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University. Yesterday, President Biden kicking off a three-day tour of Pennsylvania. It's, of course, a crucial battleground state in the coming general election. He had a speech that focused on taxes and aiming to contrast his policies with those of former President Trump. In Scranton, his hometown, Biden spoke about the tax code in the frame of economic fairness. He argued that Trump's tax cuts have benefited millionaires. But let's let the president speak for himself. Here's an excerpt from what he had to say in Scranton yesterday.
Folks, trickle-down economics failed the middle class. It failed America. And the truth is, Donald Trump embodies that failure. He wants to double down on trickle-down. His failure starts with his $2 trillion tax cut that overwhelmingly benefited the wealthiest and biggest corporations and exploded the federal debt when he was president. Donald Trump added more to the national debt than any president of the United States in a term in all of American history. More to the national debt. Meanwhile, when the pandemic hit, Trump failed the most basic duty any president owes the American people, a duty to care and a duty to respond. Remember when he told us, don't worry, this will all be over by Easter. Remember when he told us, literally, inject bleach. Bless me, Father. Look.
President Biden yesterday in Scranton, his hometown. Jonathan, let's start with you. A couple of questions here, but let's start off with the narratives that you see the Biden campaign shaping up here, putting the president out here in Pennsylvania. An economic narrative, but plenty of other ones here too.
Sure. You know, it emphasizes his working class narrative, right? That he's just, you know, just a boy from Scranton who made good. And it also emphasizes, you know, the things that the Democratic Party has traditionally been known for: support for unions, you know, support for industrial workers, you know, steel, of course. And so to that end, right, among other things, Biden announced that he was proposing a 300%, up to 300% increase on steel imports from places like China, which is continuing a policy that Donald Trump sort of revived in the modern era. And it's mostly symbolic, right? This mostly contributes. U.S., I don't think, imports a great deal of steel from China directly. And so this is, you know, it's all part of the package, right? All part of the, that we are supporting, you know, the Democrats are the party of the sort of working class, and the Republicans are the party of the rich fat cats, which, of course, is a narrative that itself has been challenged among others, Donald Trump in recent years, right? As the particularly the white working class has shifted allegiance in places like Pennsylvania and all over the country from the Democratic to the Republican Party. And so to that extent, Biden is, you know, appealing to this group that has been, you know, shifting away in recent years.
The current president facing still dismal approval ratings. I think they've seen a bit of an improvement for him. Donna, is this the way you see him winning over more voters if we hear more speeches like this in the months to come?
Well, certainly Pennsylvania is very important in the overall electoral college strategy for Biden. It's a swing state. He's there. He's there for 3 days, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Going across the state. And, you know, the backdrop of this is that their primary is April 23rd. You know, again, it's to emphasize to, you know, listeners that, you know, these events are still going on, but de facto Biden's captured the nomination, as has Trump. But these events are still going on. And, you know, he's doing these with an eye towards the general election. And Pennsylvania, as you mentioned, is his home state and originally, and the industrial base there is very important. And so he can, you know, do these campaign events and emphasize, especially on the economy, things that we should probably see the administration or the campaign, I should say, hammering home as we go to the general election. You know, one of the problems for Biden is that despite the fact that the economy is hugely improved, and I do mean hugely, right? Unemployment is historically low. Lots of indicators, you know, our growth, our economic growth is well outpacing other countries in the world coming out of the pandemic. And so the United States economically is doing really quite well, but it's not being felt by a lot of voters. And that's largely because there's an inflation hangover, if you will. And inflation has come down. We saw it tick back up maybe a little bit in the last report. But in the things that consumers pay for daily, they're still feeling the effects of, you know, inflation. Prices haven't come down. And it's not Biden's fault that that has happened, but presidents get blamed for economic conditions. And Biden's trying to, you know, take credit for the good things in the economy, also talking about, you know, prospectively what he would do. But this is going to be something that we're going to see the administration or the campaign talk about over and over and over again, because theoretically this should benefit the Biden campaign, but it hasn't really hit, I think, to a lot of people in terms of how they're viewing the economy yet. And you know, perception is very important here. Even though the reality is one thing, the perception of voters is another thing.
Yeah. And just a reminder, tomorrow on this program, we'll be digging into that disconnect between the mostly good economic news we've had since the pandemic over the past years, recovering from that, almost all the economic indicators really showing positive signs. But then people, and especially we'll focus tomorrow on how Iowans are not necessarily feeling that. Tune in tomorrow for that. Let me ask this, though. We have plenty of road to travel down before we get to the election. Jonathan, let me toss this to you. Looking, we talked about Congress here. We're talking about the presidential election coming up. Looking at the congressional map, what outcomes are possible? It seems, you know, from what I've been reading, we could see anything from Republicans controlling both chambers of Congress and the White House to Democrats controlling both chambers and the White House or anything in between.
That's right. There's wild uncertainty here. You know, the polling is very close on lots of things. And I think there are lots of reasons why, you know, there's not a lot of state polling in particular. They're very small sample sizes. They tend to be even more unreliable than sort of more general election polling. And so it's just really hard to get a sense about, you know, local races. I mean, we have to remember that, you know, Congress every 2 years, right, we have all 435 members of Congress up for re-election, plus, of course, a third of the Senate. And so there's no one out there polling, you know, 445 races. So ultimately, yeah, it's. I think the conventional indicators that we have are in some ways pointing in different directions. So the some of the polling is pointing toward, at least for now, right, toward a GOP pickup, at least in the House, perhaps in the Senate, because the structural conditions sort of favor the GOP this round in the Senate. But there's other indications that maybe that won't be the case. So the Democratic Party is flush with money. The GOP is not. The Democratic Party has had a really great run of special election wins around the country. And, you know, special elections are weird and odd and hard to extrapolate from. But there has it's kind of been a consistent trend of Democrats really overperforming expectations in a bunch of special elections. And so, you know, what that means for November at this point, it's just very difficult to say. I think, as Ben, you're right, that any outcome really here is possible.
Let's move on to a couple of other things before our hour gets away from us. The Supreme Court case heard this week, and also, according to reports, appearing divided over allowing a key January 6th charge. Justices hearing arguments about whether prosecutors improperly used a federal law to charge hundreds of Capitol rioters. The ruling, not expected until July, could, though, undo rioters' convictions and sentences, further delay Trump's election interference trial in D.C. I guess the question here, Donna, comment on this, whether a 2002 law prompted by white-collar fraud applies to the obstruction of congressional proceeding on January 6th. Help us understand the significance of this case and the law being used.
Well, this particular amendment that was done in 2002, as you mentioned, stems from the Enron era, in which documentation was being destroyed, evidence was being destroyed, and so the obstructing corruptly obstructing an official proceeding is what's at issue here, and so a small portion, I think about 350 of the 1,400 people charged with the insurrection in January 6th. Have been charged under this provision. So it's not the sole thing that's being charged, and many of the people who are charged under this are also being charged with other things, as is the person who has brought this case to the Supreme Court. And so, you know, the court has to answer the question of, you know, is this really the intent of Congress when they did this law? And so the government's arguing that, of course, this would fit under this, corrupting an official proceeding of Congress, and it's not clear how this is going to flesh out. It's really problematic. Most Supreme Court watchers will argue to, you know, look at the oral argument and predict what's going to happen. So we don't really know. And I would caution, you know, that we know here because a lot can happen before that. This is also one of the charges that pertains to Trump, but again, related to January 6th that are federal criminal charges, but there are also other things that he is charged with there. So it could have implications for one of Trump's federal trials, but there would be other things if this were to be judged, you know, something that really wasn't appropriate by the Supreme Court, there would still be other things that he could be charged or that he is charged with as a matter of fact. And then also, you know, speaking of the Supreme Court, they're going to hear arguments on the 25th of this month related to Trump's presidential immunity. And whether he, you know, as president, as an ex-president, is immune. And so those things are coming up before the Supreme Court as well. So we have a lot of things in the courts, state and federal, going on related to Donald Trump.
The time quickly ticking away in our hour, a few minutes left. I wanted to make sure we address the Middle East conflict, of course, because of what happened there on the weekend. The latest, you know, Iran's unprecedented barrage of aerial strikes on Israel over the weekend, most of which were intercepted. I understand Israel's war cabinet ending another meeting to discuss a possible response to the attack. The Iranian president warning that the slightest attack by Israel on Iran will be dealt with fiercely and severely. Meanwhile, the UN human rights chief urging governments to do everything they can to stop the misery in Gaza as nearly 2 million displaced people remain in really appalling conditions under constant threat. Jonathan, start us off here. Your thoughts on Iran's unprecedented attack, what chapter this opens for us?
Well, it's not a great sign for stability in the Middle East, certainly. I think in this case, it's a good way for, you know, Iranian hardliners and Netanyahu's more hardline members of his cabinet to find something they agree on, which is fighting each other. In both cases, I think you know, they benefit from extended hostilities. So Netanyahu, who is deeply unpopular in Israel, is, you know, will lose the next election as soon as the war is over, wants to keep the war running. I think there are, you know, hardliners in the Iranian government who feel the same way and want to. So, you know, unfortunately, we've got people in power on both sides who very much want to exploit this conflict for their own political gains. Now, whether or not it leads to a wider Middle Eastern war, it certainly might. You know, if Israel's retaliation isn't proportionate, then Iran, I mean, the whole thing could easily spiral out of control, especially because it is clear that the world, the sort of post-World War II liberal order is crumbling around us. You know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, of course, showed that, but also what's happening now in the Middle East. American influence has declined. The role of international institutions to stop conflicts like this is really at a low point. And so in that sense, we can all sort of hope for the best and hope that Israel's response is not grossly disproportionate and, you know, pulls the lid off this boiling pot.
Mm-hmm. Strong political ripples from the Middle East to here in our domestic politics. Donna, your comment.
Yeah, so the real question here, right, is, as Jonathan pointed out, you've got those extremists on the multiple sides here, but will cooler heads prevail? And Biden is certainly trying to influence Netanyahu in terms of responses. We saw this before the Iranian actions. And Biden doesn't seem to be making a lot of headway. There's not a lot of love lost between Biden and Netanyahu. And as you just mentioned, right, this has some ripple effects into our domestic politics as well, because you are seeing within the Democratic coalition some there wanting Biden to do more related to aid to Gaza, related to humanitarian concerns that Biden doesn't have a lot of control over in terms of what Israel is doing. But nevertheless, the Biden administration needs to, hear those criticisms they're getting from within their own coalition and act on those things. And we've seen some Biden administration actions trying to, at least illustrate that they are hearing these concerns.
Yeah. Speaking of the coalition that Biden put together to win the White House in 2020, Jonathan, do you see him dealing with that coalition in regards to the strife in the Middle East well or not so well? It's a tough situation to be in in his position.
It is, of course. I mean, as Donna said, the U.S. influence over Netanyahu in particular is very, very limited. There's essentially enormous congressional support to give Israel whatever weapons they want. So it would be difficult for the Biden administration to threaten to cut off politically. It would also, of course, alienate lots of pro-Israel American Jews who, you know, live in politically important and populous states like California and New York. But of course, if Biden also risks alienating by not pressuring Israel, Biden very much risks alienating, especially young people who are overwhelmingly pro-Gaza. Young people in the broadly across the Democratic coalition seem to be broadly pro-Gaza and, you know, generally have turned against Israel in the last 4 or 5 years. But also, in particular, there are large, Muslim and indeed Palestinian communities, particularly in Michigan, which is, of course, a crucial swing state. And so in that sense, yeah, Biden has to walk the knife's edge. I think ultimately, more or less, regardless of what Biden does, most of these voters will come back home again during, you know, for their vote because the alternative is Donald Trump. Some, of course, may go to third parties like RFK. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you know, that's what, you know, political tribalism in America is all about, right? Is that even voters who are, you know, most angry, you know, voters who find Donald Trump personally repugnant are going to vote for him. And I think ultimately most Democrats are going to come home for Biden.
We've run out of time once again. Thank you for the expert analysis. Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Donna and Jonathan, we appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
Today's program produced by Danny Gare with help from Maddie Willis. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.